This is the podcast Surgery IC Rounds. My name's Jeff Guy. I'm an associate professor of surgery at Vanderbilt University Medical Center. Today is February the 19th, 2008. The topic that I want to discuss today is atrial fibrillation. Atrial fibrillation, as far as problems in the intensive care unit, can almost be classified as a nuisance. It is common, it has multiple potential etiologies, all of which could be serious, and it is complicated by multiple potential therapies, all of which have varying success. Atrial fibrillation is a common arrhythmia in the intensive care unit, second only to ventricular tachycardia. A study by Ryan Elton in Intensive Care Medicine in 2001 demonstrated that atrial fibrillation may occur up to 31% of patients in the medical, cardiac, or surgical intensive care unit. Rathor and colleagues in Circulation in the year 2000 demonstrated that atrial fibrillation is associated with a significant longer stay in the intensive care unit. In-hospital mortality was associated with acute myocardial infarction is higher in patients who have had atrial fibrillation, 25% versus 16% for those who don't have atrial fibrillation. As I said earlier, atrial fibrillation is associated with a variety of cardiac and extracardiac condition, some of which are chronic and some of which are acute. Some of these conditions which can lead to atrial fibrillation include surgery, especially cardiac or thoracic surgery, a pulmonary embolism or other pulmonary conditions, myocarditis, electrocution, alcohol consumption, thyroid disorders, or other metabolic conditions. We can also see atrial fibrillation associated with a history of hypertension or those patients who have coronary artery disease. Goldbergs and colleagues in American Heart Journal in 2002 reported that 11% of patients presenting with an acute MI develop atrial fibrillation during their hospitalization. Also, valvular heart disease, especially mitral stenosis or mitral regurge, resulting in some left atrial dilatation, are commonly associated with the development of atrial arrhythmias. Among some non-cardiac conditions which can lead to atrial fibrillation, Wang and colleagues in the Journal of the American Medical Association in 2004 reported that obesity is an important and as a risk factor at the development of atrial fib. There is a relationship between the size of the left atrium and an individual's body mass index. There's a lot of definitions that get thrown around in regards to atrial fibrillation, and some of the definitions need to be defined. There's the term lone atrial fibrillation, and lone atrial fibrillation is used to describe atrial fibrillation in individuals yet less than 60 years of age and who have no clinical or echocardiographic evidence of cardiac disease. Levy and colleagues in Circulation in 1999 reported that 45% of patients who have paroxysmal atrial fibrillation and 25% of patients who have chronic atrial fibrillation have no cardiac disease that can be identified. It's been hypothesized that changes in autonomic tone appear to play a role in the initiation of atrial fibrillation, particularly in those individuals who have structurally normal hearts. Both vagal and sympathetic tone may surge in the minutes immediately preceding the development of atrial fibrillation. Now, getting back to some of these definitions, there is a nomenclature for the atrial fibrillation. And episodes of atrial fibrillation can be defined as either first detected, recurrent, paroxysmal, persistent, or permanent. Now, recurrent atrial fibrillation occurs when a patient has two or more episodes of atrial fibrillation. That's considered recurrent atrial fibrillation. If atrial fibrillation terminates spontaneously, it is considered paroxysmal. So, the definition of paroxysmal atrial fibrillation is atrial fibrillation that initiates and then terminates spontaneously. Persistent atrial fibrillation is atrial fibrillation that is sustained beyond 7 days. And permanent atrial fibrillation occurs if cardioversion has failed or has not been attempted and the patient has been in atrial fibrillation for longer than 1 year. That's what we're calling permanent atrial fibrillation. Now let's discuss the pathophysiology and isn't anything regarding intensive care and ask what is the etiology of a particular problem in the intensive care unit. A safe bet is always the answer that it's multifactorial. What we typically worry about in surgical patients is that the adrenergic outflow or adrenergic stimulation and inflammatory cascade are common among postoperative and critically ill patients. The mechanisms for this are not completely understood. There is an upregulation of the angiotensin system, which may lead to the development of atrial fibrillation as well. pronounced increases in the white blood cell count have been described as an independent risk factor for the development of atrial fibrillation, particularly in patients who have undergone cardiac surgery. And that's been described by Lam and colleagues in the Journal of Cardiothoracic and Vascular Anesthesia in the year 2006. Statins, which everybody seems to love nowadays, have an anti-inflammatory property, and the statins have been shown to suppress some of the electrical remodeling in animal models of atrial fibrillation. And the statins may reduce the incidence of postoperative atrial fibrillation. One potential mechanism for the ability of statins to reduce the likelihood of postoperative atrial fibrillation is their inhibition of metalloproteinases, oxidants, and mediators of inflammation. More on this can be found in the article by Marin and colleagues in the American Journal of Cardiology in 2006. But there's a long list of things that can lead to atrial fibrillation. Mitral or tricuspid valvular disease, myocardial disease. It may lead to systolic or diastolic dysfunction, valvular abnormalities, pulmonary hypertension, systemic hypertension, pulmonary embolism, intracardiac tumors, thrombi, coronary artery disease, pericarditis, amyloidosis, myocarditis, alcohol, caffeine, hyperthyroidism, pheochromocytoma, increased parasympathetic activity, increased sympathetic activity, subarachnoid hemorrhage, cardiac, pulmonary, esophageal diseases, and these are only to name a few. Now, atrial fibrillation can lead to a decrease in the cardiac output, and this is what most people are worried about, is a decrease in cardiac output or a decrease in cardiac oxygen delivery. And this decrease in cardiac output can manifest as a fall in the blood pressure and result in pulmonary congestion. Now, several mechanisms have been put forward to describe the adverse hemodynamic effects of atrial fibrillation. These include the rapid heart rate, the loss of the atrial kick, irregular ventricular rhythms, as well as some neurohormonal mediators such as norepinephrine and angiotensin II. Now, many people are certainly aware of some of the dangers of elevated heart rate. Keep in mind that the real determinant of cardiac output is heart rate times stroke volume. And one of the things that certainly affects stroke volume is the period of diastole. That's the amount of time in which the heart is beginning to fill. And as you shorten that diastolic time, you're decreasing the diastolic filling time. And that's going to decrease the stroke volume or decrease the end-diastolic volume, which will decrease the stroke volume. The other thing to keep in mind is that the myocardium is perfused during diastole. So as you're increasing the heart rate, you're decreasing that diastolic filling time, which is going to decrease the end diastolic volume, which has a negative effect on the stroke volume. It drops it. The other thing that happens is that since the diastolic time is decreasing, the period of time in which the heart is being perfused by the coronary blood supply is reduced due to that decreased diastolic time. That loss of that atrial kick people like to talk about is really more accurately referred to as atrial systole. And in some individuals, this could be associated with a 20% reduction in the left ventricular stroke volume. And it could be up to high as 35% reduction in the left ventricular stroke volume in patients who have recently suffered from a myocardial infarction. Those patients who have heart disease that associated with a diastolic dysfunction, or they have a left ventricle that is poorly compliant, they rely heavily on that atrial systolic kick for filling of the left ventricle. In some conditions which this can be aggravated even more are those patients who might be suffering from a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, those who have mitral stenosis, aortic stenosis, or severe cerebral vascular disease. Certainly one of the ones scarier cardiovascular problems with people who have atrial fibrillation is when they develop a rapid ventricular rate. So when you see somebody who has atrial fibrillation, the first thing you want to know is their ventricular rate controlled or not? Because you can get AFib with rapid ventricular rate. We'll see a ventricular rate running in the 160s and 170s, and clearly you know that that is not good for the patient. It is not good for their cardiovascular status, and it is a terrible thing for their heart. Additionally, patients who have rapid ventricular response may actually see an increase in the activation of neurohormonal vasoconstrictors, and this can result in additional increase in the vascular resistance or the afterload, and as well as coronary vascular resistance with a subsequent decrease in coronary perfusion, in addition to having the negative effects of that rapid ventricular rate. So let's break that down again. If you have AFib and somebody has rapid ventricular rate, all the scary things that are associated with that heart rate of 170 are in play. Decreased diastolic filling time, decreased coronary perfusion, increased myocardial oxygen consumption in the face of a decreased cardiac oxygen delivery. Add on top of that fire the fact that you have these increased neurohormonal vasoconstrictors increasing the systemic vascular resistance as well as increasing the coronary vascular resistance. Let's take a brief time out. Now let's talk about the management of atrial fibrillation. The management of atrial fibrillation is really divided into three elements. First of all is control of the ventricular rate. Okay, so you can have somebody who's got AFib with a rapid ventricular rate. You need to control that ventricular rate. The second is trying to restore normal sinus rhythm to the patient. And the third objective is the prevention of thromboembolic complications. So let's outline that again. First thing to do is try to control the ventricular rate. The second thing to do is try to reestablish normal sinus rhythm. So you're trying to convert AFib back to a sinus rhythm. And the third thing is prevention of thromboembolic complications. So when you first go see a patient in the intensive care unit, you're called and they have new onset atrial fibrillation, is a determination of actually how sick is the patient. Is the patient in extremis? Is their blood pressure 70? Are they in florid pulmonary edema or acute heart failure? If you go see your patient and they're having chest pain, they're in pulmonary edema, or they've got that blood pressure of 70 over something, they really are the patients who are in that emergency arm of the algorithm, and these are the patients who are candidates for emergency cardioversion. It has been my experience that when you're dealing with younger physicians or house staff, is that when somebody sees VTAC or VFib, we know the thing that we need to do is to cardiovert the patient, and we need to do it quickly. I think where people kind of make some gaffes, if that's the appropriate term to use, is that when you see somebody who is in atrial fibrillation or AFib with a rapid ventricular rate and they're hemodynamically unstable or clinically very symptomatic, is people seem to have a little bit of a difficulty deciding that that's a person who's appropriate for electrocardioversion. Now, if your patient isn't one of those ones that are an extremist, they're not having chest pain, they're not hypotensive, they're not in pulmonary edema, then you've got a little bit of more time, but what you're going to focus then on is controlling the ventricular rate. So if they're AFib with a ventricular rate sitting in the lung 60s and lung 70s, your first priority, aside from the obvious airway breathing circulation, is try to get that ventricular rate down. Drugs that are good for the consideration of controlling that ventricular rate are beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and digoxin. Now, when we're talking about the calcium channel blockers, there's a class of calcium channel blockers called the dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, and these are drugs like the nifedipine, and these drugs have no effect on atrial ventricular rate, and you don't use them to try to control ventricular rates. The calcium channel blockers that we're talking about are the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers. Now, in the postoperative surgical patient, beta blockers are a great drug because we may be dealing with drugs who have a high adrenergic tone. Now, when we talk about beta blockers in postoperative patients, it seems that beta blockers now are the cure for everything that ails you, including the heartbreak of psoriasis. But we know, and it's certainly a well-established fact over the years, and it's been demonstrated in the literature, that the use of preoperative beta blockers in patients who are considered certain risk factors undergoing non-emergent, non-cardiac general surgical procedures have a improved postoperative cardiac profile from complications if they're given beta blockers preoperatively as well as the beta as the postoperative period. And the reason for that is that the beta blockers will, if given preoperatively, will abrogate some of the body's response to that increased flowing of things such as epinephrine and norepinephrine that we see associated with injuries in surgery. So in the postoperative patient who is having atrial fibrillation, a beta blocker seems like a natural choice. Metoprolol is a reasonably good drug for this. It has an onset of action of a few minutes and it can be repeated up to about 3 times in intervals of every 5 to 10 minutes, as long as the patient does not develop any hypotension or any observable adverse effects. The other nice thing about metoprolol is that once you've got adequate control of the heart rate, then the patient may be transitioned over to oral doses of metoprolol. Esmolol is another great drug for this use, particularly in the intensive care unit. Esmolol is also known as Brevibloc. What I like about Esmolol is it's a reasonably very short-acting drug beta blocker. It has a duration of action of really about 7 to 9 minutes, and it's very helpful in patients who are at risk for hemodynamic instability since the drug is eliminated quickly. And what I'll typically tell our residents is that, you know, if you're going to something like Esmolol versus metoprolol, Esmolol is a much, if you're going to make a mistake in that beta block somebody who may be hemodynamically labile and they could have subsequently hypotensive for this, you're not buying a long-acting drug with the Esmolol. Now, not everything that glitters is gold, and we learned in medical school that beta blockers have some problems, and one of the problems particularly is that patients who have lung disease such as asthma or COPD, we can see problems with bronchospasm. Therefore, if we have patients who have a history of a hyperactive airway disease or problems with beta blockers, we need to have another drug. And there's those patients who we give beta blockers to at appropriate doses. And I just had one of these just last week that despite giving appropriate or large doses of beta blockers, you simply do not get the clinical effect that you need to control the ventricular rate. And for that, then we switch over to some calcium channel blockers. Now, keep in mind, the calcium channel blockers we're using are the non-dihydropyridine calcium channel blockers, and the one that's mostly used nowadays is diltiazem. Now, the standard dose of diltiazem is a 0.25 milligram per kilogram dose given IV, typically over 2 minutes, and this is typically followed by a 5 to 10 milligram per hour continuous infusion. A drug that we used to use much more commonly before there was an IV form of diltiazem was verapamil. And when I was a resident prior to diltiazem having an IV form, we used to give verapamil quite a bit, but I will tell you that you get quite a bit more hypotension with verapamil than you do diltiazem. When diltiazem first came out in an IV preparation, the drug reps would tell you that it doesn't cause hypotension, and I will tell you that that is not accurate, that you will get hypotension even with diltiazem, but not to the same degree that you would see with the verapamil. A drug that is not used as commonly nowadays for a variety of reasons, but is not as sexy as it used to be, is digoxin. The nice thing about digoxin is that when you look at the beta blockers and the calcium channel blockers, in addition to controlling ventricular rate, they actually have some negative inotropic effects. But digoxin will control the rate, but it actually has a positive inotropic effect. So for patients who have heart failure or marginal blood pressures, it's a reasonably good choice. It does increase myocardial contractility, and it does not result in hypotension. The problem is digoxin is not an ultra-rapid drug. If you give somebody like Esmolol or you give them cardiazem, you can expect a clinical benefit in the ventricular rate in a matter of a few minutes. But if you're going to do that with digoxin, you have to recognize that you're kidding yourself. This is not a drug where you're going to see a rapid clinical improvement. There's all kinds of ways that we've been taught to load digoxin. Can be loaded intravenously. At again, this is going to depend on weight and people's renal function. But a typical IV load in your traditional individual is going to be something like a 0.25 milligram dose IV every 2 hours up to about a 1.5 milligram or it could be given orally. Again, patients who have kidney disease, DIG should be used with caution. We have to follow DIG levels typically after the load. And for that reason, it seems to be used, and like I said, for a variety of other reasons, it's being used with less and less frequency. It's fun to see nowadays that very few residents even know how to do a DIG load. Amiodarone is a great drug. It's a wonderful drug for surgeons, and then I call it a kind of a dirty drug. It's a wavy line drug. Much like ricanamide used to be, is that, you know, amiodarone is a drug that will convert virtually anything that has scary wavy lines, whether it's atrial or ventricular. Amiodarone does cause slowing of rapid ventricular rate, most of which occurs in the first hour of the administration following administration of the drug, although some other benefits of the drug may not be manifested for several days following administration. As I said earlier, you know, we really want to avoid these beta blockers and calcium channel blockers in patients who are presenting with pulmonary edema or have severe left ventricular dysfunction, because these are negative inotropic drugs. Here's a big board question, put a few asterisks next to this, but the use of intravenous beta blockers, the calcium channel blockers, and digitalis should be used in caution with patients who have a history of pre-excitation and Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. So again, the bottom line there, avoid beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, and DIG in people with pre-excitation syndrome and WPW. And the reason why we don't use these drugs in patients who have a history of Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome is because they can facilitate an antegrade conduction over the accessory pathways, and this could result in an acceleration of the tachycardia and basically a degeneration to ventricular fibrillation. So if a patient's got a WPW, they have a rapid, their AFib with a rapid ventricular rate, you give a beta blocker, or you give a calcium channel blocker, or you give a DIG, what happens to the heart rate? It actually accelerates. It's almost a paradoxical effect, because you're pushing the conduction, you're accelerating the conduction down the accessory pathways. Now, if a patient has a pre-excitation type syndrome, then for treatment of AFib, you can use intravenous procainamide, which is a great drug, as well as amiodarone. Now, how am I looking for this WPW? Well, what you're doing is you're looking at the EKG during a patient who has atrial fibrillation, and they have accessory pathways. What the EKG may show are irregular wide complex tachycardia caused by ventricular pre-excitation of the accessory pathway. So what we typically would say is this also looks like somebody who has got SVT with aberrant conduction, and it almost looks like a VTAC type picture with a slower ventricular rate than VTAC. But if you see atrial fibrillation with a wide complex tachycardia that looks like VTAC but actually isn't, then your best drug of choice there is either procainamide or an amiodarone. Now, here's a qualifier: that if somebody has WPW syndrome, oral beta blockers or calcium channel blockers may be used for rate control as chronic therapy with careful monitoring. I will tell you that that is not something a surgical intensivist is going to do. I doubt that that's what any surgical or medical or an anesthesiologist who does critical care is going to do. That's probably going to be something that's going to be under a cardiologist who specializes in arrhythmias. Now we have dealt with the control of the rate. Now we're going to focus on the cardioversion of the rate from an AFib to a sinus rhythm. Remember, we said that the three elements of therapy for somebody with atrial fibrillation was control the ventricular rate. The next step was to get them from an atrial fibrillation with a controlled ventricular rate over to a sinus rhythm. And the third was controlling the complications, the thromboembolic complications. So this segment, we're going to talk about the pharmacological cardioversion. Now, we'd all like to cardiovert somebody with drugs over electricity, or at least most people would seem to rather do that. But the reality of the situation is that the success rates for overall cardioversion is lower with drug therapy than it is with electrical cardioversion. And the two drugs that are used most frequently in the intensive care unit for pharmacological cardioversion are amiodarone and procainamide. There was an article in the New England Journal of Medicine last year that stated the conversion rate of atrial fibrillation to sinus rhythm during amiodarone load is only about 30%. Now, amiodarone is often used to maintain sinus rhythm after cardioversion in patients who've had atrial fibrillation, and amiodarone is also a great drug used for the management of ventricular arrhythmias. I like amiodarone a lot, and it's got several advantages to it: low acute adverse effect profile, and a neutral effect on mortality in patients following myocardial infarction and in the presence of structural heart disease. But those who are using it long term, there are some significant toxicities that one needs to be aware of. When one administers amiodarone, there are some things about it is that you don't want to shake it. It will actually kind of foam on you, and it's for this reason. It's not actually in preload syringes. It comes in little glass ampules you have to draw up. I'd refer to ACLS because they're varying doses, but at least in this in this context, we're talking about atrial fibrillation. And in the case of atrial fibrillation, it's administered as a bolus of about 150 milligrams given over 10 minutes. And then the drip rate for amiodarone occurs as a drip at 1 milligram per minute for about 6 hours, and then 0.5 milligrams per minute for about 18 hours. And then the patient's eventually converted to oral amiodarone. Amiodarone may cause hypotension, particularly if patients have a history of heart failure or left ventricular dysfunction. And amiodarone is nice because you can switch it over to an oral dose. Now, when you are using amiodarone, it's a good idea to get some thyroid and liver panels as well as a chest x-ray. Patients who are maintained on amiodarone for a long period of time can have some problems with their pulmonary function tests and diffusion capacities. It can cause an interstitial pneumonitis, bronchiolitis obliterans, ARDS, and as well as lung masses. Now, the antiarrhythmic effect of amiodarone on atrial fibrillation may not be as rapid as we would like it to be, particularly when we compare it to something like the use of amiodarone in something like VFib or VTAC. But the antiarrhythmic effect of amiodarone on AFib may not be apparent for up to 8 to 24 hours after the administration. Little side fact that you need to know is one of those fun facts on rounds. It's nice to pimp people or drug interactions. And amiodarone potentiates the effect of warfarin or Coumadin. It will raise your INR. So if you are using amiodarone on somebody who's on Coumadin therapy, you need to be mindful of this and reduce the dose of the warfarin. Other drugs that amiodarone increases the levels of are digoxin as well as cyclosporine levels for your transplant patients. Not everything that glitters is gold. All drugs have adverse effects, and on amiodarone, those will include bradycardia, hypotension, visual disturbances, nausea, constipation, as well as phlebitis at the site of injection. A problem that is seems to be occurring or being diagnosed with greater frequency or certainly an awareness is prolonged QT interval. Amiodarone can be used with a low risk for the development of torsades in patients with a prolonged QT. There was an article by a guy named Borpirian in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology in 1997. It was a meta-analysis of four trials, and it involved 738 patients who had an MI and LV dysfunction treated for at least a year. Low-dose amiodarone in those 738 patients caused no cases of torsades. Another great drug for the use of conversion of atrial fibrillation to a sinus rhythm is procainamide. It's classified as a class 1 antiarrhythmic. I'll let you look up the doses. Giving doses makes me more than paranoid. But things that are typically used as indicators to stop the administration of procainamide is the development of hypotension or widening of the QRS complex by more than 50%. And when you see either one of those two things, you need to terminate the bolus or infusion of procainamide. Procainamide is a drug that can prolong the QT interval and lead to a proarrhythmia state. And procainamide is a negative inotrope, and it does cause vasodilatation, which does limit some of its applications in the ICU. You can follow procainamide levels, both procan and its metabolite, N-acetyl procainamide, also known affectionately on the lab sheets and the order sheets as NAPA. So typically when you use procainamide, you're drawing both what we call procan and NAPA levels. And it's cleared through the kidney, so this is something you're monitoring, particularly in patients who may have decreasing or altering renal function. Procainamide can also result in a suppression of the bone marrow, things like cholestatic jaundice as well as a lupus-like syndrome. Here's a question that will certainly have asterisks. Procainamide is the drug of choice in patients with Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome who present with atrial fibrillation. So let's set another way. A patient with Wolff-Parkinson-White presents with atrial fibrillation. The drug of choice is procainamide. Good. We would like to be able to convert the rhythm with drugs, but sometimes that simply doesn't work, and then we have to go to electricity and direct current cardioversion. Works and has a high acute efficiency in converting people at an estimated rate of 67 to 94%, which is much better than drug therapy. The other real big advantage of electrocardioversion over pharmacological cardioversion is that it is immediate, and it results in an immediate improvement in the LV ejection fraction as well as the stroke volume. Those of us who have been around intensive care units know for a while, though, is that you'll have somebody electrically cardioverted, and they can basically revert back into their bad habits of going back into atrial fibrillation. And the likelihood that you will get long-term cardioversion in somebody who is electrocardioverted is basically inversely related to the duration of the AFib before the cardioversion, as well as the left atrial size. So if somebody's been in atrial fibrillation for a week and they get cardioverted, they're probably not going to remain in sinus rhythm as long as somebody who only went in AFib 24 hours ago. The other real element of that is what was their size of their atrium on the echocardiogram. Somebody with a dilated left atrium, again, they're more likely to revert back into atrial fibrillation. If cardioversion fails, patients should certainly be pre-medicated with an antiarrhythmic prior to repeating the cardioversion. And we have different types of waveform now defibrillators. In the day, we only had monophasic waveform defibrillators. Now we have this biphasic waveform defibrillators. And the biphasic waveform defibrillators are more effective in cardioverting atrial fibrillation than are the monophasic defibrillators. Now, if somebody's in atrial flutter, they're usually easier to cardiovert at 25 to 50 joules for atrial flutter, but somebody who's in atrial fibrillation typically require higher doses at basically 100 to 200 joules. What about those patients who are obese? Well, obviously, patients who have higher body mass indexes, or indices, I should say, require higher energy levels. And those patients who have had atrial fibrillation for a longer period of time and his atrium is enlarged, again, are going to need more likely higher energy levels. Now, just because they're getting cardioverted does not necessarily mean that we're going to see a troponin release. There's been a couple studies that have failed to substantiate that even using very high energy levels of defibrillation up to about 1,370 joules resulted in troponin release from cardiac myocytes. A rare complication of cardioversion occurring in 1.2% of those cardioverted is the development of pulmonary edema. This can occur what's felt to be related to stunning of the heart, and it seems to be independent of the amount of energy that was used to cardiovert the patient. Now, again, applying electricity to somebody has its drawbacks, they're obvious, but DC cardioversion can be complicated by the development of ventricular fibrillation, bradycardia, tachycardia, ST segment elevation, ventricular dysfunction, hypotension, pulmonary edema, as well as embolism. When we're performing the cardioversions, we should be performing these in the synchronized mode. And what does that mean? It means that the direct current is being delivered during the ventricular depolarization. Shock, when you shock somebody during repolarization, the shock on a T wave may result in the degeneration of the atrial fibrillation into ventricular fibrillation. Not good. Also, the electrolyte status should be normalized when possible before cardioversion to limit any proarrhythmic complications. So if somebody is, they're not the emergent type where we talked about where they're in pulmonary edema, having chest pain, cardiac failure, the pressure is not 70, but their ventricular rate is controlled, they're not symptomatic, and we're trying to convert them back from atrial fibrillation to sinus rhythm, correcting things like their calcium, potassium, and so forth prior to cardioversion is appropriate. Interesting fact that bradycardia is or tachycardia is occurring at about a fourth of the cardioversions. If the patient is having a pacemaker, again, these are probably, again, this is not an emergent cardioversion, but more of an elective cardioversion. These are situations where you're probably going to have cardiologists involved, but again, using the lowest energy necessary should certainly be used, and the electrodes should be placed in the AP position at least 12 centimeters from the pacemaker generator. The third element we talked about from atrial fibrillation, let's go back and review it. We said the first element was controlling of the ventricular rate. We said the second element was the trying to convert from atrial fibrillation to a sinus rhythm. And the third element is the prevention of thromboembolic complications. That's the element we're going to talk about now, the thromboembolic complications. Anticoagulating someone, or anybody for that matter, is a reasonably complicated process, and it has potential complications, and there are those groups of patients who have both relative and absolute contraindications, particularly in a surgical population. A patient may have, if you have a fresh post-operative patient, they may have traumatic brain injury, they could have undergone spinal surgery, and therefore we need to evaluate which of these patients are appropriate for anticoagulation. Some comorbidities that increase the complications include somebody who's postoperatively. They may have had a stroke, hemorrhage. They could have platelet disorders. They could have renal or liver failure. They could be an ARDS, or they could be a trauma patient. And therefore, the clinician at the bedside must evaluate each of these clinical scenarios and try to weigh what are the risks and benefits of anticoagulation for each individual patient. Certainly one of the things that we've seen frequently is in a trauma setting is an elderly patient who has atrial fibrillation and they're in their late 80s, they may have a degenerative neurological disorder and they're put on, or just tremors or just weakness, and they're put on a anticoagulant for atrial fibrillation, and they fall out of their wheelchair or fall down the stairs or just fall from a standing situation, and they come in with an intracranial hemorrhage secondary to a traumatic brain injury, and they have a life-threatening and life-ending intracranial bleed from the anticoagulation. If the atrial fibrillation is greater than 48 hours of duration, or we don't know how long the patient's had atrial fibrillation, or the patient hasn't been anticoagulated for at least 3 weeks, the cardioversion can be performed. But after you rule out that there is no thrombus in the left atrial appendage, and it's typically done by transesophageal echo. Now, this is clearly in a stable situation. If the patient is, as we said, hemodynamically unstable or having chest pain or shock or pulmonary edema, then you need to proceed to immediate cardioversion without the echo. But certainly one can initiate intravenous unfractionated heparin or subcutaneous low molecular weight heparin at a therapeutic level at the time of the emergency cardioversion. And I think that's a really good fact that I think many people may overlook, that you're dealing with an unstable cardiovascular situation. You don't have time to get the echo. Fine, do the cardioversion, but at least anticoagulate the patient if they have no contraindications. Arnold and colleagues in the Journal of American College of Cardiology back in 1992, and I apologize for this mispronunciation, but Nuccarelli and colleagues in the American Journal of Cardiology in 2000, both of those looked at the risk of thromboembolism following a cardioversion for either atrial fibrillation or atrial flutter. And in those studies, they found the risk of thromboembolism at the risk of about 1 to 5%. Now, Berger and colleagues, in a really large study done in 1998 and reported in the American Journal of Cardiology, looked at 32 studies, and they found that more than 80% of the thromboembolic events occurred during the first 3 days. 98% of them occurred within 10 days of cardioversion. So if you're thinking that you're going to cardiovert somebody, and then in a matter of minutes they're going to throw a clot, that's just not an accurate picture of what can happen. You can be throwing clot for several days following the cardioversion. And the real reason for this is that even after successful cardioversion, that the atrium really doesn't come back online immediately. It is somewhat impaired for hours, even weeks, depending on how long the patient had atrial fibrillation prior to the cardioversion. And it's really recommended that even following cardioversion, all patients should be anticoagulated unless there's a significant contraindication. And this anticoagulation should continue for at least 4 weeks after successful cardioversion, and perhaps even longer in patients who have a high risk profile of having thromboembolic complications. So that's a real basic rundown on atrial fibrillation, something that we see very commonly in intensive care units. And basically, there's a real outline there of how to approach that acutely, from controlling the ventricular rate, trying to convert back into sinus rhythm, and then a brief discussion there about what do we do about anticoagulation, both before and after electro or pharmacological cardioversion. I provided a few doses, though I wouldn't recommend using those doses. I would certainly make sure that you check all your doses from your drug references prior to administration of any medication. And I would also recommend that you perhaps familiarize yourself with the guidelines put forth by the American Heart Association. And those are what Advanced Cardiac Life Support is built upon. You can get those actually online from Circulation, which is on the American Heart Association's website, and they make those free to anybody. Once again, my name is Jeff Guy. You've been listening to the podcast Surgery IC Rounds.